Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars, the show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today. I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we're back again with another film from the very first Academy Awards season, The Racket.
Our second of the year.
Yeah. If you tuned in last week for the episode covering Seventh Heaven, welcome back. You're now a regular listener. Congratulations.
Good job. Well done.
And if this is your first time tuning in, what we do here is we cover every single movie that's ever been nominated for Best Picture. Like I said earlier, starting from 1927 and going all the way to the modern day.
Which is where we are currently. We're still very much in the beginning of the first year, which was the actual award ceremony was 1929, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
So, but that does encompass movies from 27 and 28.
Correct.
The Academy was like, look, we started this like in the middle of the year, so we'll stretch it back a little bit.
Right.
That way we can get my boy, I forgot his name from last year. Who's the main actor? Chico.
Oh, man. Oh, God.
That's trivia.
Don't do this to me.
That's trivia. Janet Gaynor. My boy, Janet Gaynor.
My boy, Janet Gaynor. I think that's going to be my next musical project is my boy, Janet Gaynor.
Dude, I love it. Taylor Swift has a Clara Bow song, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah.
Perfect. I've never listened to it.
I say that with 100% certainty, or with confidence, and like 30% certainty.
Excellent.
That sounds like her.
I'll reach out to the 21-year-old girl that works with me.
There you go.
And just be like, hey, I need help.
Give her 10 seconds to get through the face palm that she does.
Right.
And then she'll answer your question.
The face palm, the fist bump when she starts talking about
T-Swift.
Maybe
offer her tickets to go for that new Taylor Swift movie that's coming out.
Okay, I thought you were going to say a concert.
No. I'll save you like, $1,000.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Did you hear about that movie?
Yeah, I did, from her.
Very. Okay, so that makes sense. Thank you, 21-year-old coworker.
I don't even know what it is, though.
It's like her music video. So it's like a 90-minute thing, and it includes the first music video of this album. And then it includes like behind the scenes, and then there's like visual like aids to the album. Hmm. But it's not a visual album.
Gotcha.
It's not like a Lemonade kind of thing.
Okay.
It's more like, hey, congratulations, the album came out. Here's a fun little thing. And it's like 2 or 3 days of a run.
Money, please.
The only thing that I think is very funny about it is like, it's going to make a ton of money. Right. So much so that it's going to be number one at the box office of that week.
Yeah.
And it's coming out at the same time, same week as The Smashing Machine, which Dwayne The Rock Johnson was like, this is my number one. Yeah. This is my Oscars contender. And Taylor Swift was like, you could sit down.
Right. Damn.
We love movies here.
We do. And if you love movies and Taylor Swift, this is the place for you.
Maybe not this episode. Well, the beginning of this episode. I'm sure Taylor Swift loves this movie, though.
Probably. I'm sure that somewhere in this movie, there's like a metaphor for her career or something.
Actually, a good bit of her role in Amsterdam kind of mimics a little bit of The Racket here.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Was that the movie Amsterdam? Am I making that up?
That's a movie that came out that I never
saw. The old Russell movie?
Yes.
David Russell?
Yes. She's in that.
It's definitely called Amsterdam, right?
It is called Amsterdam. I just don't know what it... I didn't see it.
No, she definitely gets hit by a car in that movie.
Oh.
Spoiler.
Damn. Sorry, 21-year-old coworker.
Who hasn't caught up on the Taylor Swift movie from two or 3 years ago.
Well, anyway, let's get back into a movie that predates Taylor Swift by almost 100 years.
Yikes.
So, The Racket, directed by Lewis Milestone. We were just looking, and this is the first of many Oscar nominations for him.
Almost in a row.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting. I'm a big fan of the movies that I've seen from him, and I'm looking forward to covering them on the show with you.
Mm-hmm. As am I.
Also starring Thomas Meehan, Marie Prevost, Louis Wolheim, and our favorite rat, George E. Stone.
Aw, was he, wait, He wasn't Sewer Rat from
Sewer
Seven.
Yeah.
He was Sewer Rat?
That was him.
Wow, my guy was busy.
He was.
I know it's a year later, but still. It's good to see people taking off.
Right? I'm glad he's finding work.
Good for him. What's interesting about this is that compared to Seventh Heaven, which had so many nominations, this is only nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. Which, how do you feel about that when that happens in the modern day?
I always have some questions about how a movie can be nominated for Best Picture, but not anything else. Because to me, Best Picture is the culmination of everything else, right? Did you have some excellence in acting? Did you have excellence in directing, writing? Like, there has to be something that leads into that. This being the first ceremony, I'm willing to look past that a little bit. But also, there's some performances in this that kind of felt like, you know, especially with other categories, I'm not sure what the what those contenders were, but specifically, the character of Nick Scarcy is pretty rich.
He's pretty solid, right?
Like, I mean, the lieutenant is very good too, but Scarcy alone is kind of like, well, that's your winner. Like,
yeah.
He was really great.
And that's Lewis Wolheim you're talking about.
Correct.
So he plays the gangster Nick Scarcy, and the just what his face does in this movie is so impressive and definitely campy by today's standards.
The word that came to mind so many times watching it was punchable.
Yeah.
Like, he just has such a great punchable, like, look of like, oh, I got you right where I want you.
Yeah.
Kind of situation.
He has this severe, like, underbite.
Yeah.
Where he's almost bulldogging.
He is.
It's, he just looks like a gangster.
He does nail it, yeah. And specifically, Captain McQuigg, Thomas Meegan, I thought he did really well, but he has to kind of play more. There's nothing comedic about those performances. Well, kind of. But it's mostly a serious performance on both sides. But he kind of has to play the straight man to the Nick Scarcy character and his more intimidating, like, to your point, campy character.
Yeah. Wolheim definitely had way more fun with this role, imagining.
Oh, yeah.
But like you said, Meehan, this straight character, not only is he kind of limited in what he's able to do, I think his character's a little boring, personally.
Yeah, no, I agree.
As I was watching this movie, this is my second time seeing it now, and I had originally given this movie 1.5 stars on Letterboxd. Spoiler alert.
Interesting.
And as I'm watching it, up until like halfway through, I was like, what was I thinking? I actually really like this. There are some really interesting shots. The story is compelling enough. What was I talking about? And then I think right after, there's a funeral scene. Right after that takes place, right around the halfway mark, I completely lost interest in this.
Yeah, that's fair. Because it kind of turns into a bottle episode, right? Like, it is very contained to the police precinct.
Yes.
And that's kind of the rest of the movie. Almost playish.
Yeah.
Like, the camera really does say, like, okay, well, here's side A of the office. Here's side B. Here's McQuigg's office. And then here's the basement where the prison actually is. And that's it.
Exactly. Yeah. There's some wonderful camera play early on in the movie, and that completely goes away. And like you said, it's a stage play from that point on, which isn't always a bad thing, but when you've showcased so many cool things prior, you really just lose interest.
There's a really fun shot at the club. You see from the same angle, actually, you see Scarcy and his gang come in, his group, and they just walk down the stairs, and it's a really great shot because it's almost like unintentional. Like, it feels like they kind of found like a crack in like curtains where you can see them walk in, but they're not the focal frame or the focus on the frame. But then they show the shot a second time when the police arrive, and maybe it's the score change that happens with it, but that was just such an interesting, like, it wasn't like a technically amazing shot, but it was just such like a, you didn't just do this straight on, you found a different way to do it,
right?
And that, and then the chase sequence that happens with Chick and Helen and then the police, I thought that was such an interesting thing, that the rest of it felt more contained. And contained isn't really something that you want to hear in the second half of a movie.
Right.
That's only an hour and 22 minutes long.
Yeah. That club scene you brought up is definitely the highlight of the movie for me.
Right.
The blocking in the entire club is so cool. Like you said, nobody's centered up in frame.
Nope.
There's a part where a rival gang shows up.
Yes.
And there's this really cool shot underneath the table, kind of sitting at the hip of Nick Scarcy. You see him holding a pistol. And down, deep at the other end of the frame, is the rival gang member. And it's so cool because the focus is on the rival gang leader. If this would have been filmed a few years later or now, they would have used what's called a split diopter shot. Where,
yes.
Oh, it's so cool. I was going through my notes while I was watching this movie from the first time I watched it. And just like with Seventh Heaven, I wasn't adding a whole lot because I'm like, oh, I think exactly the same as I did 4 years ago. Great. I've evolved so much. But one thing I did add was the idea that they probably would have used a split diopter. And that's something that I picked up the last couple years, like working in the film industry. So I was like, I still have the same thoughts, but now I'm educated.
Yeah, I'm sure back then you were thinking like similar to me of like, it'd be great if this guy on the left was in frame, but like also the group in the right wasn't.
Yeah.
And then now you're just like, that's called split diopter.
Right, right.
I think that would have been a great shot of like Nick kind of like realizing that something was happening and having him in the left. And then the split diopter is the rival game coming in from that shot. Like that would have been fantastic. But again, you know, and we'll talk about this more next week when we talk about Wings. But there's just so many amazing things that they were able to accomplish at the time with these cameras. Because, you know, I think that we look now as a society and say like Wonners are like fantastic. And like, wow, look how cool this shot was. But like those are all they've watched these movies and gotten the inspiration that they needed from them. This was kind of just like on its own. Like they made these things up in real time. And again, we'll talk way more about this next week, but this one wasn't as flashy, but I thought the way that they used these angles were very effective.
Yeah. I think this not being nominated for anything but Outstanding Picture gives you an opportunity to see Lewis Milestone's ability as a director. And that's something that we'll see as early as next year with All Quiet on the Western Front. His blocking, his camera work, it's all very, very impressive. And had there been a category for anything like that other than director,
right?
Absolutely, this would have gotten a nomination.
Over Seventh Heaven, I agree. I think it's fair to talk about what we've already talked about and exclude Wings for right now. But I think that of what we've seen of Seventh Heaven and The Racket, I would easily give it to the Racket over Seventh Heaven, just for direction.
Yeah, which is so funny because Seventh Heaven got that director nom.
Yeah. And maybe it was because, like, you know, earlier on, like, maybe it was, I don't want to say participation, but, like, maybe because it was earlier on and it adopted some of those things, and, like, a year later, it's like, of course, it was a little bit different. Maybe they gave it to him for that, but I don't see it.
Yeah. I think a lot of it, too, has to do with the low amount of people nominated in each category in general.
Definitely. What did you think about Marie Prevost as Helen Hayes?
So, I like the way her character is written. She's very no-nonsense, very, you know, you're not the boss of me.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of fun. But beyond Lewis Wolheim, I didn't think anybody was super interesting to watch in this movie, including
because
Thomas Meehan.
They're not Scarcy.
Right. Yeah. What about you?
I thought she was fine. Granted, I don't want to necessarily label her as this because it was so early on that she was probably like, you know, the foundation of this archetype, but she was very much that archetype.
Yeah.
Of like the, you know, we first see her as an entertainer and she attaches herself to Scarcy's gang to get that notoriety and kind of like get, you know, somewhere in life. And then she makes a turn and that turn happens almost extremely suddenly.
Yeah.
And what's kind of interesting, and to your point, boring, is that Captain McQuigg, he specifically is the central morality of the movie. And everyone around him is kind of dancing with morality. And inevitably, Helen Hayes and is it Chick who the individual she ends up with at the end?
That's actually Joe Scarcy, Nick's brother.
Nick's brother, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, the one she ends up with.
Correct. Because Nick's brother is who she leaves the club with.
Right. I don't remember who that is. I don't know if it's Chick because Chick was arrested.
It's not Chick. I think he may have been a reporter.
Yeah, he's just like some nice guy.
Yeah, he's not just involved. A nice guy. So she kind of like uses him a little bit throughout the movie, but then inevitably realizes that no one cares about her but him. And maybe technically that individual she ends up with, maybe that's the other like morally centered character. But again, it's kind of boring seeing these characters, Helen included, but mostly Scarcy, act circles around mm-hmm. McQuigg and just have a lot of fun with the scene. And McQuigg is just like, these fools, like the whole time. And it's not a bad movie. It's just, you know, I think it gets a little, to your point, boring when the majority of the second half is focused on McQuigg and his precinct and his team. But if there are some standouts outside of Scarcy for me, it's the two journalists that almost behave like hyenas.
Yeah.
Just like chomping at the bit for like some kind of meat. I thought they were excellent and so much fun to watch.
I would have loved if the casting would have been replaced with like Laurel and Hardy or like Abbott and Costello kind of.
Absolutely.
Or
they weren't dumb. Right?
No.
They were definitely just played more as like, this is their role and you have to be this way to kind of get by.
Yeah.
But if they were played a little bit more comedically, maybe.
Right.
But I agree. That would have been amazing.
Because one of them is a drunk.
Correct.
The whole time he's just plastered. And the other one's kind of the, like, hey man, like we've got stuff to do. Let's go. Or Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yes. Oh my God. If they did like a remake of that, that'd be perfect.
This would be a great movie to do a Hot Fuzz style remake of.
Now, that's a really interesting thing that you brought up, and I think that's an interesting segue to talk about how watching this movie, to me, it just felt so vanilla, might be the term, where it's just kind of like, yeah, okay, cool. There's absolutely nothing offensive about this story that they're telling. At the time, that wasn't the case.
Right.
Right back then, like, this was an extremely controversial movie that actually limited its release because the depicting such a corrupt level of Chicago was not cool back then.
No.
Was not appreciated. Like, does that surprise you to think that like a movie like this was considered controversial at the time?
During this time, I could definitely see it because we're talking about like prohibition.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and they're showing cops drinking on the job and things.
Right.
Or stealing hooch out of the trucks of gangsters. So I can see how that would be taken from the police in Chicago as a super negative image for them.
Right.
Yeah. So it was banned in Chicago, like you're talking about.
Specifically Chicago. And that was because of the police force and city government specifically is what they cited. Obviously, with Nick Scarcy, it makes sense that there's going to be some like comparisons to Al Capone.
Sure.
Right. That's what he's modeled after the most. But I do think, and maybe it's just the way that they chew the scenery on this, but way more of a camp performance than Capone. Like, he's still intimidating.
Yeah.
There's a shot that I really like, a moment that I really like, where Nick is being interrogated within the police force because he's come to get his brother. And the police officer talking to him isn't moving at all, isn't budging. And there's, like, this really great tense moment where he's kind of, like, unfolding all seemingly seven parts of his jacket.
Right.
and obviously he's reaching for a gun, but he's not. And things escalate and the police officer turns around and then Scarcy just shoots him immediately. And to your point, the campy performances, that's a very tense moment that just, there's no comedy to it. It's just very tense. It's played off really well. Great moment of release. But then Scarcy does something where he drives off and then seemingly 3 minutes later just comes back around. He's like, what's going on?
Yeah.
What happened here?
I heard there was trouble with the police precinct. Does anybody need help?
And that to me is just so Looney Tunes.
Yes.
Like, that's a Daffy Duck logic of like, I know what will make them think it's not me.
Yeah.
If I show up.
They'll never guess. Yeah. It does get very, very cliche.
Sure.
And I really don't know if that's what it felt like back then.
I'm sure it didn't.
But boy, by today's standards, by the end of this second half, I'm just like, I've seen this. And I've seen it done way better.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate it. I think the intro is very engaging, right?
Totally.
There's a lot of outside shots of like people who aren't in the focus, but you can see kind of like peering over like buildings and like out of windows. It's just, it feels very realized and lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very engaging. And again, that club scene was just like so tense and thrilling. But then you get to that second part and it's more like, well, this happens and then this happens and then this happens. And there's a great Scarcy moment, but then this happens.
Right.
And it just doesn't really come together. So part of me is a little perplexed as to how it ended up at the Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good to know that even in its first year, compared to its like, you know, 50th, 75th, 90th, that the Oscars still love a little controversial moment. So I'm sure this getting banned in Chicago was a pretty interesting thing for them to include as Best Outstanding Picture. But outside of that, watching this, I was like, this one, This is what got nominated for Outstanding Picture.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to table that with 2025 expectations of, like, you know, Scorsese probably saw this and was like, oh, yeah, this is what I should be doing.
Yeah, I am always curious what, like, kings of the genres think about these very early genre pictures.
I have to think that they herald them in some sense, right?
But not all of them.
Not all of them. I mean, granted, I think this is so early on that it inspired something from the 40s or 50s that individuals like Scorsese do cite.
Right.
Right. They're seeing more from the 40s and 50s than this. And also, just with technological achievements, it's probably more likely that they're going to cite something from the 50s than like a silent film from 1928.
Yeah. I imagine there's a lot of love for Public Enemy, you know, which was, what, the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
That's not too far off from this, but I've never really heard this movie talked about. And I don't think it's just the silent aspect of it. I just think people kind of don't hold it to as high a degree as things like Little Caesar or Public Enemy from the 30s and 40s.
Right. I think that there's something that I want to discuss here, and that was the racket itself, right? The titular racket. And I think that the racket that they're trying to tell us is very much that corruption within the police force, within Scorsese overall. I think the real racket that I want to talk to you about is that this is the second movie that I watched on Tubi.
Oh, yes.
The second movie that I watched on Tubi for this podcast. And the second movie in a row where the incorrect score was used. Now, it makes sense to me that there are music rights. There's liabilities, things that you may not have the rights to. My understanding is that if you didn't have the rights to those things, you wouldn't get the movie.
Right.
Not that you'd have to change the score. So it's interesting to me that this is the second movie out of seemingly how many. Like, who knows?
Right.
Could be a plethora of silent films on Tubi that are using the incorrect score. And I realized it about halfway through, maybe a little under, when, and I cited this to you, the score was effective, right? It wasn't the same song over and over. This wasn't offensive like Seventh Heavens was. But specifically, the Ballad of the Nutcracker came on in that club scene. I was like, all right, I have some suspicions here. And I went to YouTube and watched the rest of it in its correct score. And the score was serviceable. But my question to you is this, right? I want to complain about that a little bit, so everyone be on your toes when you go on Tubi and watch these movies. Buy them if you can. What was your thoughts on the score of The Racket compared to Seventh Heaven?
So the score for this movie is really interesting to me because it's... The score from Seventh Heaven is the score that existed for at least 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
This was a score that was recorded and composed in 2004 when the film was recovered, because this was a lost film until 2004.
Oh, so we don't know for certain what the original score was.
No, we don't.
Interesting.
So this was recorded, I forget which orchestra did it, but because this film was lost for so long, it was found in 2004 in Howard Hughes's private collection.
Interesting.
Then they remastered, they preserved the film. If you watch it on YouTube, it has the long list of credits. Not from the actual film, but from the restoration of it.
Right.
Including the score. So it's interesting to think of composing a score for a film that came out almost 100 years ago, 80 years later.
Right.
Even just the instruments used are different. I don't know. It does have kind of more of a, I keep using the word, but like a cliche score. Probably because it had so many gangster films to build off of.
Right.
The inspiration for what we know to be gangster now was used to make the score.
Right.
So it's so weird to think about this inception of sound.
Well, I think it's inherent nature for us to want to like discuss certain movies and say, you know, this felt like derivative might be a word, but also like an amalgamation of certain things, right? But that's interesting because in that sense, it's almost like a game of telephone. Over 80 years.
Right.
Of like, well, the score kind of sounded like this and then also inspired this, but then we take what it inspired and then kind of turn it back into itself. And it's a blend now. It's a blender of like what it was and what it inspired. And that's interesting because, and this is my final point on it, score's fine.
Yeah.
Not memorable. Great. Nothing great. Like it's serviceable. But going back and watching Seventh Heaven with the correct score, it very much looks for the moment and says, here's what we want you to feel in this moment. And it is memorable in that sense. This was more, and this kind of led to my overall opinion of the movie, pretty good movie, like pretty great overall. Very good for its time, but the score that's available now is just not anything special.
Yeah,
unfortunately. And when you're talking about an outstanding picture, especially compared to Seventh Heaven and what's to come, there's a lot more interest that I have, a lot more that's like morally interesting than this is.
Yeah.
But because it was controversial at the time, I'm sure it was very much a point of interest with this of, can you depict this? Is it safe to depict this? Something that we've seen later on with All the President's Men, and even later on with like Killers of Flower Moon, like, can we talk about this? And if it's held in that same kind of conversation and weight that we did have with Killers of the Flower Moon, then it just seems all the more important.
Yeah, and this, I don't think the discussion in this movie is as heavy as Killers of the Flower Moon. But beyond Chicago, I do wonder how widespread that controversy went. I was thinking about The Untouchables earlier today.
Sure.
You talked about McQuigg being like this very, very morally good police chief.
Yeah.
But he lets so many people get away with so many things, even at the police station. They're drinking. He's like, hey, you shouldn't do that, man. Anyway, let's go catch Scarzy, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know. But there's that famous scene at the end of Untouchables where they catch Capone, they book him, whatever, and they ask Kevin Costner's character, like, what are you going to do now that it's over and Prohibition is ending? And he's like, oh, I think I'm going to go have a drink. And he spent his whole career, you know, fighting against alcohol running and things like that. So it's, I really don't know what the everyday man's feelings were about Prohibition or organized crime or corrupt police departments. Probably not great about the organized crime and the corruption. But was anybody really, really concerned the same way that Chicago was because they were directly targeted by this movie?
I would say no. Yeah. I can't imagine they were, because the thing that I keep thinking about was, like, again, I enjoyed the movie overall. It's definitely not a bad movie, but in terms of importance and in terms of what it's doing, I'm trying not to have the 2025 lens here when I talk about this, but it feels kind of like a fifth grader's report on Chinatown.
Yeah.
Where they're like, this happens and then this happens and then forget it, kid, it's Chinatown. And like, that's kind of the end of this movie.
Right.
Is like, hey, did this go down the way I wanted it to? No, but I guess that's just life.
Yeah.
And things happen. That's Chinatown. And it just ends. And it just doesn't seem that inspired. It doesn't seem very well thought out. It almost seems kind of like the decision was made to make a controversial film and not do too much else with it.
Yeah.
But again, I'm very much trying to watch the movie as a standalone project and not think about what's inspired or what came after. And I think that the main thing is that if this did not have Scarcy and did not have that role played specifically by, if Wolheim wasn't playing Scarcy, this movie is dead in the water.
Yeah, I agree. Scarcy and also some of the camera work
in the first half. Yeah, you're right. And I did like some of the supporting characters, the journalists specifically. But it's funny that you mentioned Sewer Rat is in this movie, because I feel like there's like five or six sewer rats in this movie. Of just characters who are just kind of like, listen, see, get over here.
There's a lot of like Muggsy kind
of. A lot of Muggsy.
Yeah. Especially that the club scene.
It's literally Scarcy, like Helen, and then like everyone else is just Muggsy.
Yeah. They're all the weasels from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
So they totally are.
It's pretty solid at that point.
Man, this would have been a great movie if it was all weasels.
Wouldn't it?
Like, if this was like a Muppets, but one character is played by a human type movie.
Yes.
This is a great one.
Dude, I was talking about some of these old movies that are kind of out of the mainstream eye now, like The Racket. I would love to go back and remake these movies with some kind of twist.
Yeah.
And I think that the weasels from Who Framed Roger Rabbit would be so good here.
Let me pitch something to you. And what I'm going to pitch, I already have the confidence in, is 1,000 times better than this movie.
Hmm.
If the Muppets were to make a series where they would remake 100-year-old movies.
Yes.
Right? So it's in the public eye. And now they can remake these movies and make it, like, you know, aware to another audience. Do this movie.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are Muppets. Weasels, maybe, as the Muggsy characters. But maybe rats. Right?
Yeah. Bunch of Rizzos.
The McQuigg character is Sam the Eagle.
Yeah.
Easiest cast I've ever done in my life.
Yep.
Miss Piggy is Helen. The individual she ends up with is Kermit. And the only human, my proposition here, Brandon Gleeson as Scarcy.
Okay.
Put Brandon Gleeson in the Scarcy role, yeah, chewing scenery around the Muppets. This movie rocks.
That's pretty solid.
That's what I'm trying to say. And maybe that's not such an inspired casting choice because so much of Wolheim invokes a Gleeson type.
Yeah.
You talked about that bulldog nature and like that chin that just kind of extends somehow further than you would think it should.
Right.
But he just has this like, it's not even charisma, but just like he absolutely wears his emotions on his sleeve because you can tell in the look in his face what he's thinking. There's no like, you know, enigma to this man. Like, he is corrupt. You can tell he's corrupt. The way he's smiling at you, you know he's corrupt. The way he's talking to you, you know he's corrupt.
Yeah.
But he's enjoying being able to get away with it. He's untouchable, so to speak.
Oh.
I think that there are people like that who have done such a great job now. Gleeson is one of the best, I think, doing it. I would love to see something like that. If that ends up happening in 2 or 3 years, I'm expecting a paycheck.
You'll probably still be expecting that paycheck.
I imagine I will. Disney, please.
Right, yeah. Disney, please do something for us. So you mentioned the second half of this film kind of feeling like a stage play.
I did.
This was adapted from a Broadway play by, I can't read my own writing, Bartlett Cormac. So
I really hope you got that like so wrong because of your handwriting.
Yeah, it's Jeff
that
Smith.
That says Bill Murray.
Yeah. But that's always interesting to me because as we'll progress through these movies a little bit, especially once sound becomes a concept, there are lots of films that have been adapted from stage plays where they translate them to the screen and they quite literally are just filmed stage plays. And those are always really hard to watch. There's not a whole lot of movement going on with the characters. They feel really, really stationary and dull. It's fun for these silent films when they're adapting them that way. You get people like Scarzi, who's, you know, really kind of eaten up just all of his body language and things. That all exists now. And that's going to go away very soon in our show. With the invention of sound, that became a, hey, you've got to stand right here.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make any other noise other than the lines we've given you. And it makes for such dull movies. So as much as I complain about the second half of this movie and everybody just kind of standing around and stage playing it, it's still so much better than what will come in like 4 or 5 years for this type of movie.
You know, and maybe it makes us appreciate, you know, that's the reason that we draw ourselves more to these Wolheim performances is that we don't get to see this as often, right? Like we see people pretending that they can chew scenery like that, but no one really captivating you like Scarcy. There's some great character work in Seventh Heaven, but you don't have a character like Nick Scarcy, right?
You don't.
So I think the reason that even in 2025, we look back and, you know, we reflect on that kind of performance is exactly to your point, because like you don't really get that again. You do, but it takes like another, I don't know, 20, 30 years to get to that point where you kind of have someone, you know, your Eastwoods that kind of can almost literally chew scenery around them.
Right.
So I think you're dead on. And, you know, that's why maybe this is acknowledged because of the individual performances and its controversial nature. But again, kind of begs the question, why wasn't it nominated for anything else when clearly you have supporting actor or even best actor right there?
Right. And I think that really, really just kind of boils down to, hey, we're going to nominate 3 people.
Sure.
And this was probably number 4, you know, in the list of nominations.
True. Because with Wings alone, I'm sure there's multiple opportunities.
Yeah, I don't remember. The winner of best actor is not in a film that we're going to watch this year. I'll spoil that right now. It was Emil Jannings, and I've not seen any of the movies that he was in for this Oscar year. So it's hard for me to say like, oh yeah, he absolutely deserved it. We shouldn't even be talking about Lewis Wolheim. But I agree with you. This is the strongest performance of this movie. It really showcases Lewis Wolheim's talents.
Yeah.
It's very sad. He actually passed away a few years after this from stomach cancer.
Oh no.
So we'll be seeing him in All Quiet on the Western Front. And he's fantastic there as well. But that's kind of like the very end of his career. Thomas Meehan, on the other hand.
Under the Meehan.
Right, yeah. He, we kind of talked about it. His character's just not really written in a super interesting way.
Right.
And I wish he was more like 100% morally good.
Yes.
His flip-flopping makes him way less interesting to me. I was more invested in the police officer that Scarzi does the pulls the gun on him and shoots him in the back. Way more interested in him because he was very, very stoic and very hard cut. I'm a good guy.
Yeah.
I don't take money, bribery, whatever. And then, you know, he got shot in the back. So there's that.
I just keep thinking about that scene specifically because it does feel like, and maybe this is hindsight, it does feel like a good 25 seconds goes by that Scarcy reaches in his pocket and something comes out where I felt like I was in a horror movie where I was like, get out of there. What it's are you so doing? Funny. Leave.
See, and in the Muppets remake, this is where he would reach into his pockets, his like 27 different pockets, and constantly pull out something ridiculous.
Rubber chicken is guaranteed.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's completely true.
A gun at one point.
Yeah.
And but the cops just like, whatever.
Yeah, just like multiple drugs and everything's being popped out. And they're like, what else do you have? Something that I wanted to talk about with this was kind of the way that we look back on these movies. And one way that you can do that is obviously by looking at like Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb reviews and all that. So Rotten Tomatoes is interesting because there are a collective, hope you're sitting down for this, 6 reviews.
Whoa.
Of this movie on Rotten Tomatoes.
We need to get on there.
7. Hello. So 7 critics specifically. The aggregate review or percentage is 100% for this movie based on the reviews, right?
Wow.
And here are what the critics are saying. The critics are raving.
Right.
Variety said, a good story, plus good direction, plus a great cast, and minus dumb supervision, is responsible for another great underworld film. That is the most underwhelming review.
It is. That's from...
For 100% reviewed.
From Variety?
From Variety, yes.
Why don't I work for Variety?
Like, I think good pops up 2 or 3 times in that sentence.
Good.
Good, great cast, minus dumb supervision. It just feels kind of like a participation trophy of like, yeah. Like, that review to me is the word yeah. I'm just like, yeah.
Yeah. Watch it.
Yeah.
Don't.
Like, if there was like a, if there was a written out way of communicating like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's that review. Dude.
It's how everybody complains now that our media literacy is going out the window. And you hop on TikTok and you see a review and people are like, yeah, Superman was mid. That's half a step above mid.
At least mid has a definition behind it that you have to go and look up. And this is just like, good, great, stupid, dumb. Okay, thank you.
5 stars.
Great underworld film. Yeah, it's interesting, and it's certainly not bad. I enjoyed my time with The Racket a good bit, especially when I was watching the correct score, Tubi, but, or listening to the correct score, rather, or the intended score, I should say, for 2004 and on. Right. But beyond that, it just felt like it was lacking any urgency, it felt like it was lacking any compassion, and it felt like just another nominated film, and not one that was particularly interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think that's fair to say, or do you think that's like looking back in hindsight?
It's one of those things where unless you were living through the time, or you've managed to watch all of the best films that have come out that year,
right.
Now it's hard to say. Like, yeah, this one you could probably overlook and be okay with, or feel the opposite and be like, hey, what are you talking about, Ryan? This is one of the greatest films ever to come out of 1928. But from today's lens, it does feel like, okay, they nominated this. Cool, it's a gangster movie. It has some good this, some good that, as Variety so graciously put it.
Eloquently put it.
Right. But it is kind of a, look, we've seen it. Other people have done it better, told the story better, shot it better, acted it better. And I don't think that's a terrible thing to say about a movie that's 100 years old.
Mm-mm.
Especially, you know, we're not downplaying its strengths.
No.
So from like your movie journey guides, I think what we're saying is this is worth checking out if you're interested in the historical value of these movies. If you're interested in seeing like really unique camera work from a time where they were just learning how to do this stuff. They were making it up as they went. It's strong for that. And Lewis Wolheim.
Those two alone, I would agree.
Yeah.
I think, I can't remember if we use this phrasing off or on pod. So just to err on the side of caution, I'll say it again. It's not flashy. It is effective.
Yeah.
Right? The camera work is nothing, you know, we'll see differently in next week's episode. We'll talk about it. But it's so effective, what's captured here. And what's disappointing, I guess is the best way to put it, is that that effectiveness that we see in the camera work is almost thrown to the wayside in the second half.
Right.
To kind of embrace that play-like element that you pointed out was an adaptation. So, of course, it is. But the intention is, if you're ever going to play something differently as you do on a play and as you do in a movie, you have to stage that a certain way, right? We can't just say, well, I filmed a play, so here's my movie. Like, right. That's the play. So you have to be very careful about how you do that. And I think that it falls to its falls on its sword a bit in that second half. But that first half, so many great moments that, again, are thrilling in an otherwise very just like, you know, by the numbers situation. So I agree that the camera work is great. I think it's a bit different than what we're going to see moving forward here this year, but still very interesting. And it's a good stepping stone for, like you mentioned, you know, the director goes on to do All Quiet on the Western Front. He goes on to do Ocean's 11. Like, there's a lot of great work that he goes on to do because of this. So it's a really great stepping stone. It's in the same sense that I don't know many people who would say Memento or Following is Nolan's best work, but it's the stepping stone of how he got to those places.
Right.
So it's good to admire it for that alone. One thing I wanted to mention about this is that we complain in big 21st century, really, that all we see are remakes, right? We're intellectually bankrupt as a studio, as a community, because we're just watching all these remakes. It's important to point out that this was remade, right? A lot of the movies that we're going to be talking about here were remade as early as the 50s.
Yeah. I think even earlier, because Seventh Heaven was remade in the 40s with Jimmy Stewart.
There you go.
So two of the two movies we covered have already, we found out, been remade.
Within 20 to 30 years later, were being remade. Yeah. So it's important, and we'll talk about those remakes, but it's important to remember that this is just how things tend to go. People look at what was popular before, they find a way to reinvent that, and they remake it. So this specifically was a remake in 1951. Robert Mitchum, Robert Ryan were the two leads on it. You said that the 1940s is when Seventh Heaven was remade, right?
I believe so, yeah.
And we'll be talking about next year, All Quiet on the Western Front. That was remade by the same director who did Conclave, actually. Blanking on the name. I shouldn't have mentioned it without knowing his name. My apologies to this man.
It's okay.
I actually almost wore, this is not a video podcast, but I almost wore my other Super Yaki t-shirt. I'm wearing my Go to the Movies shirt today. I almost wore my Conclave shirt that has Stanley Tucci on the front, and it says Vote Bellini. And on the back, it says Don't Be a Meanie, Vote Bellini.
That's so good. That's so good.
So in, what, 5 years, 10 years, when we get to 2025 Oscars and we can talk about Conclave, outfit is picked out.
Perfect.
It's either that or I'll be wearing a Cardinals outfit. So whichever one I can find.
Ooh.
Wouldn't that be a great idea?
Patreon goal.
Patreon exclusive. Yeah. Get Ryan and Kyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In a Cardinal outfit.
That'd be pretty solid. I want to dress like Isabella Rossellini, though.
I think you could pull it off.
Yeah.
I think that I could pull off a Stanley Tucci, a Bellini performance, if not just for, there's a line where he says, it's like, and I wish they did this for the Oscars, the Academy Awards ceremony in 1929, but when there's always like one line that was written and performed in the movie that you're like, oh, that's the highlight reel.
Right.
Right. In Conclave, it's Tucci talking with Ralph Fiennes, and Ralph Fiennes says, I don't want to start a war. And Stanley Tucci says, this is a war! And like slaps his hand on the counter. You're like, yeah, that's the stuff. I'm sure there's a Scarcy performance or line in here that does feel like there's your highlight reel.
Yeah.
But I think it's mostly just everything he does.
Right, right, right. Bringing him up one more time before we get into like, what was your rating and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
You mentioned last week with Seventh Heaven, the title cards, how there weren't enough.
Yeah.
There's a ton in this movie.
I appreciated that.
Okay, you appreciated it. That's how you feel about it?
I didn't think it was too much because, you know, it was something that we talked about and going back and replaying it in my head, it definitely sounded like Toddler Learns How to Walk.
No.
Where it's kind of like, yeah, it made me like have to like infer what they were doing and like when they nod their head what that means. Of course, that's what that means. But in this, there's still very much that, but there's also just a lot more dialogue. Right?
Right.
I feel like there is probably a similar amount of dialogue in Seventh Heaven that we just don't get to see. And in here, we get to see it. And there's a speech actually that McQuigg gives towards the end where I think he's talking to Scarcy. And I can't remember exactly what he says, but it has like a 3 or 4 parter, right? Where he's kind of like, one card would say like, it's not going to happen. And the next card is like, not here, hyphen. Next card is not now, yeah. Hyphen, not ever. And that to me feels like the staging of it makes it feel much more dramatic. Mm-hmm. And I like that way better than putting it on one card or like you inferring that he's saying something for a little bit longer. It felt like whenever someone's talking, you never have to do the Leo thing and be like, what'd they say? What was that? Like, you knew what it was. So I wasn't bothered by how much there was. And maybe it's because it was an hour and 22 minute movie and compared to the 2 hours of Seventh Heaven. I felt like there was much more opportunity within Seventh Heaven to have those title cards mm-hmm. and share what was happening between these characters where I didn't feel that gap in The Racket.
Yeah. I think these two movies specifically are a great example of the artistry that goes into title card writing.
For sure.
Because Seventh Heaven being a romance film, sure, you say a little bit with the actual title cards, but then you show the romance. It's easier to do that with the man and a woman in love than to showcase kind of this arch enemy kind of relationship between Scarcy and McQuigg. So right. Also you want to highlight like the gangster lingo and slang and everything. So it relies heavier on like quippy lines and cool dialogue. It's cool that the genres are kind of what dictate how many title cards are going to be used. I wasn't like bored by the amount of title cards. I just thought it was so interesting. Someone had to decide like, oh, I need more.
Right.
For this reason.
Well, it's interesting because I think that there's like a lack of narrative guidance that's needed for things like The Racket mm-hmm. and even inherently Seventh Heaven. We'll talk about it next week, but I think that there are some situations, some examples within Wings where there's a few too many title cards, for my opinion, because there's more of a narrative or narration that's mm-hmm. provided, right? It's not these characters kind of telling you what's happening with them. It's more an overview provided by like a distant voice that's telling you what's happening.
Right.
And that makes up a lot of those cards. And that's something that we didn't see with Seventh Heaven and The Racket. So it does feel more like a story rather than like, you know, an experience that we're watching.
Yeah.
And tune in for next week. I don't think that some might be surprised what that means. I think it's effective, but it is a lot more of the screen time that's taken up by the physical title card.
Yeah.
Which, no surprise, makes it the longest running entrant
sure.
in these nominations.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be interested to see your opinion on the use of title cards.
You'll hear it.
Cool.
You'll hear it.
Cool, cool.
So what would you rate The Racket then?
Like I said, I had done 1.5 stars, felt weird about that.
How long ago was that that you watched it and gave it that review?
That was the first run of Once Upon a Time at the Oscars, so 2021,
okay.
I think.
So maybe like 4 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
First half of this movie, I was like, what was I thinking? There's so many cool things.
Yeah.
I need to rate this higher. By the end of the movie, I was like, I know what I was thinking. I did bump it up to 2 stars.
Okay.
I love the camera work in the first half of the movie. I really do. You can see the influence that it's had on later movies so clearly. I just wish it stuck around through the whole film.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that the review system in general, and let's say we're going off Letterboxd,
yeah.
right? Should be 10 stars because that allows for more nuance, mm-hmm. right? Like what's bad and like what's good. So there are movies that I've liked far less than The Racket that I feel like I've given a 2-star where I was like, yeah, not for me. And maybe it's because I hate disappointing people. So even though like, you know, Walheim's never going to see my Letterboxd review.
Yeah.
I'm still like, good job, buddy. 3.5 stars.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I need to like be a little more like cold-blooded and just be like, half star. Sorry, Michael Bay. But I think for this, like 2 stars sounds about right. I'd probably go 2.5.
Yeah.
I enjoyed myself fine. But again, I feel like 3 stars is kind of like, uh-oh. That's my uh-oh review mm-hmm. of like, something's not right here. And I don't think that this is inherently wrong. Like, there's nothing that's really wrong with this. It's just the lack of direction that I felt
yeah.
in the second half. And for the shortest entrant of these nominations, it's kind of surprising, right?
Yeah.
So a reluctant 2.5 with the intention of a 3 is maybe where you can put me down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I think we need a 10. Not us specifically, but like as a universe, we need like the 10 star.
I do think you're right because a 2 sounds damning.
Yeah.
But if it's a four, that's, you know,
participation.
Right.
And you're like, good job, buddy.
Yeah, yeah. I liked some of this.
I have to think of it more like in the teaching aspect where, like, if you get like a 56, mm-hmm. that's not like, hey, you're the worst person who's ever existed. It's like, I see what you're trying to do. You just didn't get there.
Yeah.
Whereas if I got a 15, it's like, all right, you need to just redo this altogether.
Yeah.
So I need to think of it more in that style, and that's more on me than it is this podcast and our review system. But I think I've just been too generous. So what I mean to say is, if you're a director out there and I've given you 4 stars, just be on the lookout.
Watch your back.
Watch your back.
That could change.
A 2.5 is coming.
Yeah. All I need is one rewatch and everything changes.
Is that not the truth?
That's pretty much everything I have to say about The Racket. I do recommend it. Honestly, I'll probably recommend every single one of the movies we watch because I want people to see these for the educational value of it, of understanding where we came from.
Well, and this is only our second, our third episode, but our second movie that we reviewed for this, re-entry in the podcast series. But it's already kind of changed my outlook on the way that I review things, but also just the way that you watch these things, because it's not just, hey, I've heard this movie's good, check it out. Like, this is literal history. Like, yeah. This is how we got to this point. This is how, you know, forget it, kid, it's Chinatown, like, before I saw the movie, because that's something that just lingers with you, and maybe not, you know, one-to-one, but this is the foundation of that. Like, this is what starts that kind of concept that rolls into those movies. So I agree with you. I think inherently these movies are all something that I would recommend. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that I went back to revisit these. I understand that we don't have enough time to talk about everything we want to talk about and see all the things we want to see. But it's important to make time for the things that are historical because, yes, I love to go to the movies and watch these things. And in a just world, we would have more historical theaters that are playing these movies that we can revisit. So I want to take a quick moment to shout out an experience that I actually didn't have, but you had, the Strand Theater, for playing older movies that we can go back and revisit and see these things in real time and kind of experience history a bit more. So thank you to the Strand, and hopefully there are more theaters out there that are capable, not just willing, but capable of playing movies of this caliber so we can share those experiences with you guys.
Yeah, that brings me to a good point. Talking about theaters that take the time and the energy and have the ability to show these movies. If you want to write into the show, let us know, like, if there is a theater by you and if you've ever had an experience going to see a classic film in a theater. And, you know, that can be anything as old as going to see Wings on the 4th of July, or, you know, maybe you went and saw The Batman from 1989. I guess just Batman is what it would be called.
Not something in the way Batman.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a really exciting experience. And I was thinking of putting together a list of, like, not movies you need to see, but movie-going experiences that are important, like seeing a live organ or seeing a 3D movie, drive-in movie, that kind of stuff. And I think just going to see any classic movie is such a big deal. So if you want to write into the show and let us know anything like that, but also your thoughts on any of the movies we're watching for this Academy season, shoot us an email at outaopodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on social media. Most of that is OUTAO Podcast or Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. And check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/OUTAO Podcast. All of this is going to be linked in the show notes, but we've got some early episode content on Patreon. I do a newsletter every month, and we're still working out some other things that we're going to include. But it should be good stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's going to be great. I mean, so just to touch on the thing you mentioned there at the end, you know, I think that theatrical experiences are really important. And just to inspire everyone with the suggestions that they can bring in or experiences that they've had in theaters. One of my favorite things that I did was early on in the pandemic, it was 2021 for my birthday. Taylor and I, actually my wife, we rented out the Strand theater for the two of us to watch a movie, and they just say, like, if you can provide the DVD or the Blu-ray, we'll play it. And so cool. I was like, I'd love to see Gremlins, one of my all-time favorite movies, but I feel like anyone's gonna play Gremlins. Like, I can see Gremlins in a theater without me having to orchestrate it.
Sure.
Easily. And that's true. That has happened since then. So I opted for the next best thing, which is, why don't I play Gremlins the New Batch? Which is never going to happen. And I talked with the the guy up front when we did this, and he was like, would you be cool if I played the Key and Peele sketch of how they made Gremlins 2?
Oh.
Right before the movie. And not only is it impossible, very unlikely, because I believe in a beautiful world, very unlikely that someone, some theater is going to be like, hey, here's Gremlins, the new batch. Mm-hmm. You're never going to find a theater that is like, by the way, here's a double feature with the Key and Peele sketch about Gremlins, the new batch.
You're saying he suggested it.
He suggested playing the YouTube video before the movie. So it's like, instead of your Pixar short in front of Pixar, you're getting the Key and Peele sketch about Gremlins, the new batch, before Gremlins, new batch.
That's cool.
And I was like, if I wasn't married, let's get married. Like, that's a beautiful suggestion to make to me. So that's the kind of thing where it's like, you're never going to be able to see that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's goofy, and it's literally a Looney Tunes movie, almost literally a Looney Tunes movie. But that's the glory of these experiences, that you have these movies that maybe aren't the best thing in the world, but they mean a lot to you, and you have that shared community.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about this podcast, is we have that historical accuracy and going back and revisiting these movies, but it's all about community, and it's about how these movies talk to us and we talk to each other. So, to Kyle's point, reach out with those experiences with your favorite things that you've experienced in theaters, whether it be something glorious like seeing Jaws at the fabulous Fox Theater with the Mighty Mo playing a performance beforehand, or seeing Joe Dante's sequel to Gremlins in a theater before a Key and Peele sketch. So write in, share us your experiences, and we look forward to sharing those on the pod in the future episodes.
Yeah, and support your local indie theaters. Cause,
please.
I mean, clearly theater people or movie people love movies.
Yes, and so do we, and we are theater people inherently, and we'll go ahead and just put that stake in the ground. We'll see you soon at the Plaza, and hopefully we'll have a screening within years.
That'd be so cool.
Of one of the movies that we're talking about here at a place like the Strand or the Plaza, because you got to support your theaters, not just your AMCs and your Regals and your Cinemarks, but your local theaters, because they care about these preservations as well.
Yes, 100%. That's gonna do it for this week's episode, though. As always, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll
see you at the movies.